to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today I have co-host Ashley Colby with me and a very special guest, somebody along with her partner, Mike. I've been following for a few years and has been very inspirational to me and many others, is Yuvi Ivanova. How are you doing, Yuvi?
I'm pretty good. Yeah. Cool. Thanks for having me, guys. This is great.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. So perhaps we can get started by talking about your journey. I found out about you, you know, from Future Thinkers a few years ago. And at that time, it seemed like you were kind of into transhumanism or techno-utopianism and human potential movement. And I think you're still very interested in the potentials of technology, but you definitely seem to have evolved in certain ways. That's just from an outsider coming in. So with that kind of outsider, you know, very ignorant perspective, do you want to just talk about kind of what led you up to what you're doing right now?
Yeah, sure. So it's always interesting to hear the outsider perspective. And well, the thing is, Mike and I have been podcasting since 2013. And we've been together since 2011 or something. So it's been over a decade. It's been a long time. So naturally, you know, evolution would happen. I mean, if it didn't happen, that would be strange, right?
Right. It would be strange.
And also, you know, from the outside looking in, people kind of see us as one thing, right? Mm-hmm. But we are two separate people with actually very often very different views and different interests that we weave together into a semi-coherent whole. So, you know, even with that perspective of sort of techno-utopianism, like Mike is way more techy than me. And he's always been very technical and very knowledgeable about technology. And, you know, he experiments with it a lot. Whereas I am more of a passenger with that stuff. So we did discuss things like transhumanism and techno-utopianism quite a bit. And I felt that it was just, you know, interesting abstract ideas to discuss. Mm-hmm. At least that's how it was for me. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, flex the brain and imagine what if and that sort of thing. I don't think I was ever particularly interested in the practical applications of that stuff. But now it's funny that you bring up transhumanism right off the bat, because it's one of the things that I've been contending with quite a lot. More recently, especially since having a child, I've come to the conclusion that it's a very, very bad idea and that it's not going to work. Transhumanism is not going to work. And, you know, the best outcome for it would be like some sort of a, you know, elite class that dominates all the other people who are suffering and enslaved. Like that's
like best case scenario.
It's best case scenario. Yeah. Like altered carbon or something like that. Uh-huh. And worst case scenario is that, you know, human extinction, and just the human genome gets so damaged with all these modifications that it just goes extinct. Or maybe like a few people remain in caves who are who weren't taking the modifications. Sorry to get very dystopian right at the start.
No, it's good. You have to lay out the doom. You have to lay out the
doom. Doom or optimism. It goes in that order. So this is great.
Yeah. You start with the doom. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's, to back up a little bit, so we haven't actually released the podcast for about a year. We've just been too busy with our village on the land here, and there's just so much going on. We haven't had the time to record a podcast, so I haven't actually had the opportunity to hash this out and talk through it and, you know, debate or whatever. Mm-hmm. Some of my thoughts on transhumanism are very not very happy.
So I have two possible directions, but I want to go in this order, you know, because I think it makes more sense. I want to ask about how having a child got you to that point. But first, I want to know, like, let's just lay the groundwork. Tell us about your current project, this village. Like, I want to know, you know, the details of what you're working on.
Sure. Village. Well, we've been wanting to do something like this for many years. I think we've talked about it for the whole time that we've known each other. And we tried to do something like this in Bulgaria a couple of years ago, but we couldn't just wrangle enough interest, couldn't raise enough funding, and yeah, it just didn't work out. And then after having a child, we came back to Canada just to be closer to family. And this is also when the pandemic first hit. So we were like, well, we don't know how long these lockdowns are going to last. So we might as well come back to Canada so that we can spend some time with the grandparents. And Mike's mom was also sick. So we wanted to make sure that she gets to spend time with the grandchild. So we came back to Canada and then started looking for land here. And we were able to raise enough funding, like just down to the wire. We were able to do it. And we found some land that was suitable for what we wanted to do. And we purchased it a year ago. It has an existing campground and golf course. We're not really golfers, but it just happened to have a golf course, and Mike's parents are into golf. So they're helping run it. So it works out. And our plan is to build a village, sort of a living lab, to experiment with different things like permaculture and, you know, ethical use of technology and community building and different sort of psychotechnologies for cultural coherence and a lot of different things, just everything that we've been talking about on the podcast for the last decade, to put it into practice and see what actually works and what can nice. Come out of this.
Really quick follow-ups. First of all, my husband is super into golf, and he has this idea of a regenerative golf course, like based on traditional links courses from, you know, the British Isles. So we should talk about that later if you want. He's like, he wants to like graze animals on the golf course instead of using lawnmowers. What is the state of the village right now? Like, what is like actually happening on the ground? Before we get into more details about like what the next steps are, the goals.
Yeah, sure. So right now there's a functioning golf course, a functioning campground and RV park, and a couple of houses and a couple of community structures like gazebos where people can gather. So we are living here. Mike's parents are living here. His uncle is here as well, part-time. Mike's brother is moving here. So basically our extended family is here. Everybody's helping out. And we're currently in the process of getting permits to expand and build more structures. And we're planting our permaculture garden this year. So that's very exciting.
Nice. Is that kind of an onerous process for all of these permits? Do you have like a critique of this process at all, or does it seem totally reasonable to you?
Yeah, there's a lot of red tape, and as everywhere, I'm sure, and a lot of rules that seem unreasonable, and just, you know, bureaucrats got a bureaucrat, and just people who've never built a house or cultivated land, making up rules that seem pretty arbitrary.
Yeah. You're saying the zoning code isn't conducive to solar punk, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Dang. So yeah. And you all have you're getting other people involved, like investors, and you're wanting it to be a village with various people. I remember, I think I heard you on the Jim Rutt podcast, and you guys were talking about kind of this I guess you could say tension between, you know, wanting to have some degree of communal space, but also people having their own space as well, like perhaps their own living quarters, and trying to find this balance of like, you know, we don't want to be everyone up all up in our shit all the time, but at the same time, we want to have like, you know, a communal commons, you know, commons area as well. How's that going? How are you thinking about that? Has that changed?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty much the same as what you described. Our idea is still for people to have their own individual dwellings that they're responsible for taking care of, and to have communal space. Actually, in that sense, I think at least what I envision is kind of similar to how villages used to function, where, you know, the village has a market and a church and a tavern that are kind of common spaces, and people have their own houses. As far as ownership structures, we're still experimenting and trying to figure out what's going to work, especially because, you know, the legality and the bureaucracy, it plays a role. Like, what you can do does play a role, even if you might have some idea of what would be awesome. It's just sometimes it's too lengthy, too expensive, too complicated, you know, to put it into practice. Like, we talked with somebody a while ago who tried to do a community land trust, and it took them $500,000 in lawyer fees and several years to get it together. So it's not an easy process, but that's something that we're interested in looking into, some form of a community land trust. But to start, we're probably just going to focus on rentals, because one of the things that we want to be cautious of is not to bring people in too soon and then create codependence. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that from, you know, the people that I've spoken to who've tried these kinds of projects, it's a thing that happens quite often. And we want to avoid that. So we're going to focus on shorter term stays and sort of residencies with a fixed term, where people just come in, we get to know them, they get to do some work, we see how the dynamic is, and we do some sort of a trade that's finite. You know, they trade some work for staying here, and then that's done. And if, you know, if after that we decide to continue, we can. If that's it, then that's it.
Yeah. That makes sense to me. So has that process started, of like, are there, besides family members, are there people kind of checking it out, or are you still kind of laying the groundwork for that?
It's a bit of both. So yeah. we had quite a lot of people visit. We just had a lot of campers last summer too. It was a super busy season. I think we had around 3,000 people visit. Mostly not through Future Thinkers Network. It's just, you know, it's an active campground, so people are just coming in. And we've had a few people come who are interested in the village. So we're going to continue that this summer. There's more people coming, so we'll have more to say after the season is up.
Yeah. Wow. Does it, so we often talk, you know, have this conversation of kind of the, you know, there's like different models, different theories of change of, you know, like, it seems like a lot of us in our kind of extended networks, you know, we all kind of want to move back to more kind of healthy, regenerative lifestyles. You know, and oftentimes, like, some kind of, you know, if you're thinking about aesthetics, like cottagecore, solar punk, like some kind of, you know, where there's like permacultural principles involved, and you know, there's like a thriving community, but like, how do you get there? And it seems like, you know, one track is kind of what you all are trying to do, of like, you know, build kind of the macro infrastructure of a village and let it, you know, iterate it and let it evolve. And, you know, the other is just to kind of like plant yourself somewhere. Like, I'm going to move out to a rural area, I'm going to get to know my neighbors and maybe invite a few of my friends, but it's going to be, you know, it'll lack the coherence, but it also, it probably might not be as onerous. I mean, it just seems like what you're trying to do is incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Everything about this is difficult. It's so funny. Yeah. Like, you know, sometimes we attract all sorts of people, and some people who just have wildly, like some people who are very aligned and totally get this, and some people who are just wildly have no idea what it takes to do something like this. They have some sort of vague picture of like a idyllic countryside life, or they're just sick of the city and they're looking for something different. Yeah. But they have no idea how to do it or where to start. And a lot of the time, unfortunately, they're not even willing to do the work. We find that very often, that people come and they realize, oh, I have to be like in the mud and in the cold and you know, working with my hands with like cuts and scrapes and I'm not prepared for this. Like, this is not my highest calling. I want to work on my highest calling.
Right.
They don't realize that 99% of the work. Sorry, go ahead.
Man. Yeah. That seems to be, I mean, that's the thing with all of us. I don't know what your story is, Ashley. You know, like, so we're, you know, my family, we're starting a homestead. And yeah, I mean, I didn't know much about anything building or planting. And, you know, I don't think I went in thinking that it was going to be this kind of idealized, you know, like very clean process. But at the same time, you know, it takes years to like just learn the skills, first of all. But to not even be willing to do that, like I would just kick them out as quickly as possible if that was the mentality.
Yeah, this is something I wrestle with all the time and think about all the time, because I think there is something really appealing about making a community of really cool, great people that all work hard and or like contribute to the work, and then you're like together and you're like codependent in a good way, and it's like, you know, I think like that's the fantasy. But then the reality, I was just tweeting about this a couple days ago, kind of messily working through my thoughts on this topic, and somebody said, stop looking for a community and start becoming a person that other people can depend on. We ran into so many people that talk about community and are desperate for it, but basically what they want is a group of other people to fix their life for them. Yeah. And I do like feel like there is one of the barriers to doing this well is like is finding other people who are good at community, like good at the work of it. And a part of the effect of industrial society is like we've lost a lot of those skills, not just the work skills, but also like being in relationship with others type skills. So I'm wondering if you guys think about that or talk about that at all.
Yeah, definitely. It comes up all the time. And, you know, including ourselves, like we've just been doing our own thing for so long. And through our travels, we've become very self-reliant in a lot of ways. And yeah, we just often end up, you know, doing everything ourselves instead of asking for help or instead of trying to find competent people to join us, because it's really hard. It's finding those people is really hard. And even if you do find them, a lot of the time they're kind of better at doing their own thing than being in community. One of the things that's actually been really interesting is just, yeah, finding community where we are, just getting to know our neighbors and forming, you know, forming friendships with them and learning from them and trading things, bartering things. That's actually, I wouldn't say it was surprising, but at the same time, how would I say it? It's just been really nice. Mm-hmm. And they've never heard of Future Thinkers, or maybe they heard about it, but you know, just because word travels in a small town, they are like, mm-hmm. Oh, is these, you know, city folks are moving out here, let's see what they're all about.
Yeah. Have you found that people have been pretty friendly? Like, are they at least receptive of, like, you know, they're not going to immediately close down or judge, but like they're receptive to like, okay, what are these people about, right? So you're finding that receptivity.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's actually been it's been really nice. Mm-hmm. So when we first started looking for land in Canada, we were looking in this area called the Kootenays, which is very beautiful, you know, this mountain region in British Columbia, and but it's the culture of it is very closed. So mm-hmm. people, you know, if you're not from the Kootenays, you're an outsider, you're not really welcome there. People don't want you there. They don't want more people coming in. They don't want the hype, the buzz, like they just want to be left alone. So we found a lot of, like a few people were receptive to our ideas and wanted us to be there, but a lot of people also were very wary or outright resistant. Mm-hmm. But then when we, our land purchase in that region fell through. And actually, I think it was for the best because we found a much better piece mm-hmm. of land elsewhere. And this region actually has, I guess, more people who have moved there, you know, more recently, maybe in the last 10, 20 years. They haven't been there for generations. So I found that people were a lot more receptive to us being there and, yeah, just more friendly about having outsiders coming in.
Yeah, nice. Do you have like, can you see kind of the beginnings of, if we're thinking like bioregionally, like bioregional, in terms of bioregional regeneration and these types of ideas, like, do you see kind of these kind of functional interdependent relationships with your neighbors, that where it's like, okay, like maybe we're already starting to barter, you know, can you see kind of like the potentials for like a more, you know, developed, robust, you know, economy that, you know, or eco, you know, NAMI, however you want to put it, you know, as part of the larger region? Or is that kind of, I don't know, can you see the glimmerings of something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the entire bioregion, but our sort of area of maybe within like 20 kilometer radius.
Yeah,
there are a few people. Excuse me. There are quite a few people doing some version of homesteading or raising animals or plants, or they're doing traditional crafts. We have a few neighbors who are raising alpacas and they do yarn spinning, and they do survival classes and these kinds of things. So yeah, and there's definitely, I would say, there's interest in having some sort of a community market or barter market or something like that. I've talked to a few people about that. So I think that there's growing interest in that. Yeah. And also a few of the moms here are talking about doing like a homeschooling co-op. There's definitely a lot more interest in that. So yeah, I think things are going in the right direction, even if it's not sort of at the mainstream level yet.
Nice. One other question on the village before maybe we could get into parenting a bit. But so, okay, another thing that came up in this thread the other day when I was talking, but like just thinking out loud about community, was this this model of like a medieval monastery, like a walled exclusive community that's different from the rest of, you know, the you know, social order writ large, and then, you know, it basically like has its own internal order, but that model works well only with like very rigid ideology, like very rigid, you know, belief system and set of behaviors that go along with that belief system. So I'm wondering if you've thought about that at all, like, you know, I'm thinking about your apprenticeship model, or you know, like people coming to rent for short periods of time. Like, are you like open about you know, what ideology somebody might have, or do you feel like there is some limitations on, like, we do have to have some amount of overlap to maybe cohabitate more long term?
Yeah, probably some shared values. I definitely we don't see our place as some sort of a walled garden, especially because of the way that it already is. You know, it's a campground, it's a golf course, it's already part of the community where people come in here seasonally and they have a existing relationship with the land. This was really interesting. Like, you know, there are some people who have been coming here for 20 years. So they've had a relationship with the land for longer than we have. And that plays into the context of what this place is and can be. So it already can be a walled garden, because that's not where it fits in people's minds.
Right.
And not that we ever wanted something like that anyway. Yeah, I'm guessing it's more that we need to have guidelines for play. Like, what, you know, people come into our context, and so what are the guidelines for playing nicely together? Yeah. even if people hold different ideologies, they are a guest here when they come, so they need to kind of play by our rules a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so now I'd love to hear like a little bit about your journey to parenthood and like what, I don't know, like, is there like a before baby and after baby in your mind? Like, talk to us about that, that transformation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Definitely biggest, I would say it's biggest transformation for me in my life thus far. And I've had lots of transformations. You know, all the traveling and all the heavy meditation and all that stuff, you know, I can think of many very transformative experiences that I've had, but this beats them all for sure. And it's been life-changing and amazing. And I'm really glad that I ended up becoming a mom, because for a lot of my life, I think I assumed that I would never have children, and I had my son quite late. I think I was 35 when I had him. So yeah, I'm really glad I did it. And it definitely changed, it entirely changed my outlook on the world, and for the better. There's this term that people use sometimes, seven generational thinking, where you can kind of see into the future of your lineage. And how would I say it? It's not like you see the future, that kind of sounds ridiculous, but it's that you can sense into it. You can sense into what is going to be good and healthy and generative for your family ongoing, for, you know, not just you and your children, but many generations down the line. And likewise, you also become in touch with what happened before you, the seven generations before, and all the baggage or generational trauma or whatever that comes with it. But also the history, you know, the lineage of where you come from, the traditions, the different languages and cultures that come with that. And probably all the meditation I did before has helped to lay the groundwork for sort of this expanded sense of what is self. But it's been, yeah, I don't know. I still struggle to find words.
And talk to us. I'd love to hear more about like what are the nitty gritty details about that like turned you off transhumanism in the process of becoming a mother, because that's, to me, I think I never was like big into anything like transhumanism or techno-utopianism, but being a mother made me so much more viscerally aware of the potential horrors than I would have been just like, you know, continuing as an adult. And not thinking too much about like the impacts on the body or children or those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, I would say at the core of this is that life and all living things have an innate capacity to self-heal, self-restore, to find internal balance. And meddling with that too much can have vast negative outcomes. And obviously, you know, medicine has existed for a long time, so we've been meddling for quite a long, long while. And obviously we're not isolated islands. We are in relationship with everything around us. We're in relationship with the food that we eat, with the people around us, with the different technologies. Even things like language and fire have changed the human genome in the long run, because they're part of us now. We depend on them. So, you know, our teeth have changed as a result of fire, because we can now cook food, things like that. So we are always, how would I say it? We're always transcending what we were and kind of becoming something else. And that's the process of evolution anyway. But how much is too much? And what's the end goal? And where is this all going? Those kinds of questions are important too.
Yeah.
So I suppose it depends on what people mean by transhumanism, because you could say we're already transhuman in some way. We're already symbiotic with certain technologies and things that are non-biological. So, Yeah, I guess it's always that walking the edge of how much is too much, how much is healthy, how much is tolerable, and can nature continue to restore itself from here on? And because if we do something too much in that direction, it can make the genome unstable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's self-terminating. So it's an evolutionary dead end. So I think about those kinds of things a lot. And one of the things is a term for it is hyper-reality, which is basically various kinds of simulation. And it's easy to think about it as like media or things on a screen or VR or whatnot. But there are different levels of simulation. And some of them are more negative than others. Like a game is a simulation too, and kids do it all the time, but that's positive, it's generative, it trains and teaches them something about the real world and about themselves. And especially when games are played with other living things, you form relationships through it. So that's healthy. But if a child is playing a game on a tablet and that game does not respond to them in a generative way, like the game is fixed, it's pre-programmed. It teaches them that the world is fixed, which is it stays in their unconscious and, you know, informs their other interactions. So that's not, it's not necessarily healthy. And then, you know, AI is a whole other can of worms. I wrestle with these questions all the time. Yeah. And at the same time, you can't be an idealist in today's world. You can't be a purist. I mean, unless you're willing to be Amish and cut out all technology altogether, you will come across technology and your children will come across it. And I think when I first had my son, I was a lot more bullheaded, if you will. I didn't want him to be around screens at all, and didn't want him to use handheld devices at all. But we're in a family environment, and other members of the family, when they spend time with him, they are more lenient. They allow him to play with screens. So I couldn't continue to be so bullheaded about it. So I had to develop some framework. Okay, well, so how do we do it better? How can I teach him to interact with technology in a better way? And I would say it's still a learning process, and it's challenging too, because we're all, you know, maxed out and tired, and sometimes it's just easy to put on a cartoon for him. So.
Well, yeah, that's great, because I think like, I'm of two minds. One, I get really frustrated by the argument that like writing is technology and therefore like artificial wombs are fine. You know what I mean? It's like, it's all technology. It's all the same. Like there no people not making a distinction between like, you know, just how far we can go with some of these things. But then the other part of me thinks like it does take an incredible amount of nuance to navigate. Like we are in this world. We actually do have to navigate it. Like I think about my kids, you know, they're gonna encounter screens. So I need to like find a way to teach them to encounter them in a positive way, put limitations on what kind of, you know, things they have access to at an early age, but then, you know, like they're gonna encounter it at some point. Something that horrified me the other day, my 2-year-old was looking at a book with superheroes in it, And she said, where are their phones? Like, they don't have a phone in their hand. And I was like, oh my God. Like, that's horrible, because I think that, like, we're just so, our phones are just part of our hands now, mm-hmm. that, like, that's what she's so used to seeing. And I was like, that's transhumanism. Like, oh my God, I need to put my phone down more, you know, because she's just like, thinks that humans should have phones in their hands in a picture. So anyways, Jason.
That the way to judge is like two things. One, you know, drawing on, you know, just drawing on kind of the regeneration movement, right? Is it conducive to, you know, ecological regeneration somehow, right? And if we can argue that, you know, certain types of machinery for, say, you want to build a bunch of ponds that will capture water, that will be, you know, really generative part of a permaculture project, and you bring in an excavator, I'm like, okay, you know, I'm willing to do that. Or, you know, GIS technology, geographic information systems, to be able to help us measure ecological health at larger scales, I think that can also be appropriate, you know, within boundaries. Or, you know, Web3, right, or crypto, and helping to coordinate, you know, new kind of finance based on, you know, forms of capital that we define, you know, in line with our values, that can help speed this up. I can see the role for that as well. And then I'm also, you know, we've had a couple episodes recently, you know, about, what's his name again, Ashley? The philosopher, the convivial society.
Oh, Ivan Illich.
Illich, yeah. I don't know. And you know, he, you know, I think he has a very nuanced view of technology of basically, you know, is it making us more human? Is it making us more convivial? Is it making us more present with each other? And so kind of bringing in the ecological and the human aspect, I think that's, and it's never going to be very clear cut, but that to me seems to be kind of how I would distinguish. Does it make us, you know, does it connect us closer to each other? And does it connect us closer to the earth? And if it does those two things, then I think it might have a role, even if it seems kind of out there, or alien to us at the moment.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, are you guys thinking about Web3 at all in your vision, not just for the village, but I know you also have courses, like, you know, how are you thinking about this? Because one of the things Ivan Illich, he talked about these, like, these learning networks that could be enabled through technology somehow. And this is, like, basically, I'm teaching a homesteading class, like, you have courses, there's this, like, para-academic world that's kind of blooming, parallel education kind of thing. So I'm wondering, yeah, how are you guys thinking about, you know, just using technology to these ends?
Yeah, it's a good segue. So we are actually starting a DAO, a decentralized autonomous organization. And, you know, that's probably not the perfect term to describe what it is, but that's what people call these things these days. So we're just going with the standard term for it. And it will have NFTs that are used as access tokens that are sort of the membership to this organization, which give you different perks and voting rights on certain things. And it's sort of a separate project to the village. Like, I would say it's maybe parallel, because we want to be able to experiment with different things, sort of low stakes things that don't affect the village in a major way before we start making any real big decisions. Using this decentralized, these different decentralized voting mechanisms. So, and that's the first thing. And second thing is, certain decisions just can't be made. Even though collective intelligence has its uses, certain decisions can't be made unless you're physically present here and have a relationship with the land and sort of tactical understanding of everything that's happening here. But yeah, this DAO is also going to be a big experiment, and a learning network is definitely a huge part of it. We're thinking of it as sort of a mycelial web that connects all these different projects that are doing similar things around the world, and different people maybe who don't have a project yet but want to get involved, even if they can't be physically here or at one of these places. Yeah, just kind of the start of this broader community learning, sharing web.
That's good. Yeah, I'm thinking back to this episode we had Jason with Eli and James. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the part where they were talking about like they're somewhat skeptical of these tools, in that I think a lot of people think they can just sort of outsource all of the community necessary community skills to like a DAO or Slack or something like that. Whereas, you know, they're saying like you actually do need to have those skills as people too. I'm skeptical of this, and I think you're like taking a very I think hard-nosed approach toward like, yeah, some things need to be done in person. You know, there's some things that are like only people with a stake and like skin in the game in this place can make those decisions. I'm skeptical that a DAO, like I don't know what, I'd be curious to hear what you think a DAO or like something like a DAO does that's different from like a co-op, you know, like, so I only know a little bit about how DAOs work, but I think my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because part of my goal on this podcast is just to like be wrong out loud sometimes, be the Luddite and who doesn't know things, but is the idea that you're building in some of the social rules into this decentralized code or whatever, so that people can't just make up the rules as they go along, and then that gives everybody a chance also to like maybe vote is the right way of thinking about it, like have a say in how things go. I wonder why you can't just have like a normal like cooperative type organization that has rules and like bylaws, and then everybody gets a stake through this cooperative. Like, what's the difference with Web3? I'm just like skeptical that we're needing to invent new things when there's like technologies like the institution of a cooperative that already exist.
Well, my view is possibly different than other people's, but I do think that DAOs are basically the new version of co-ops. Okay. Yeah, we just have more technologies now to aid in that process. And I think that the human social tech is still at the core of it. You know, I'm not a technology maximalist. I'm barely even a technologist. I tolerate technology.
Same.
But I also see the you know possible positive uses of it. And yeah, I think that you can't outsource certain human social things to technology and expect it to work out. Because humans are variable. Like our response is different depending on the environment. It's not always the same. So you can't program those things because, there's so many failure modes of bad actors, trolls, just lack of participation. You know, yeah, humans are not fixed. So you can't use fixed systems to deal with humans. Right. But I think there are certain technologies that can augment cooperation, especially when it's decentralized cooperation, when you're spread out across the world. I'm still learning so much. I'm not even all that knowledgeable in co-ops, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe people have already invented good ways to coordinate in a decentralized way when you're not in the same physical location.
Well, let me propose an analogy to Ashley and see if it clicks. So we can ask, you know, why do we need to use video conferencing when we could just meet in a living room?
Right, right. Right.
And because we're decentralized.
Right, right. So but then, like, my go ahead.
It seems to me that I would be less inclined to want to adopt kind of the latest gizmo, whether that be a DAO or something else, for kind of an in real life community to manage community affairs, you know, that require tactical embeddedness, you know, kind of tactical relationship, embeddedness, relationality in real life. But if we're thinking about supporting each other in these networks across the globe, right, you know, then it seems like this is a new thing, you know, that we, like, humanity hasn't really done this in a really robust degree. And that's so true. We need to utilize this technology that is kind of built for that. Right.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know what form it would take. Like, if, you know, what does it mean to be a DAO that's decentralized, but you know, your core project is a physical place, and, you know, is it about kind of onboarding people, or people have kind of investments or stakes in it, or is it kind of this mutual aid network across projects? And I'm curious, maybe how you respond to that, Ashley, and then your take on that, Yuvi.
Yeah, I think it's a good analogy. This whole podcast is just Jason trying to convince me to be slightly less Luddite. My concern is that, like, just humans gaming things, you know, and when you mm-hmm. when you decontextualize and take it out of the local, you know, I think people just think, like, you know, bada bing, bada boom, we got a DAO, it's all solved, you know, like, we're all going to be, like, perfectly equal actors and be treated equally and well, and there's no way for it to be gamed, this, you know, the system or whatever. That's, having said that, though, I think there is such a role for ways to coordinate that aren't local. But I just, like, I think that probably when you're building, I guess, the rules of the DAO, you should just do it super slowly and iteratively, and, like, minimum viable stakes that could impact people, you know, like, if people are, like, all in on something, like, maybe putting money into it or something that where, like, it's a big resource and then the system could be gamed. Like, I fear that kind of thing where, like, no one really knows how the technology actually works, and then they just put a bunch of big stakes into it, and then, you know, something bad happens that they didn't foresee. Anyways, Yuvi, like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think along the same lines all the time. You know, I'm very aware that people will game things. It's inevitable. And yeah, people will make stupid decisions. It's inevitable because they're people. So yeah, we're thinking about that all the time. And yeah, minimum viable rules is definitely our approach. Minimum viable structure, a trust first. Even the way that we're building this village, it's like trust first. We brought in trustworthy people, friends, family, longtime listeners of the podcast. Like, all of our investors are people that we know. They're not just, you know, random people gambling on the success of our project. And we didn't want those kinds of people. And we wanted, you know, people who would be physically involved, even if not all year round, but, you know, they would come and spend time here and actually have this tactile experience and build trust with us in a human way. So that's the village. But then the DAO is, again, that question, how do we coordinate across the globe with people? The way that we're, there's another layer to this. So the DAO is, a playground for experimenting with decentralized decision making in a low stakes environment. That's right. Like, emphasized low stakes. We're not talking about property ownership or anything like that.
Right.
Low stakes. So we're starting with art, actually. We're going to do a bunch of different art contests and sort of art collaborations to create Protopian art. To create regenerative art with people around the world. And so the other layer to the DAO is an NFT, which is sort of a unique token. So each one is unique. Like, let's say, you know, Bitcoin, like, every Bitcoin is identical, right? It doesn't matter if you have this Bitcoin or that Bitcoin. But NFTs, it's a token that each one is unique, verifiably unique. So it's we're using it as membership. So each person who holds this NFT has membership to the DAO, and they're able to, you know, get certain perks. You know, they might have discounted event tickets, or they might have free entry to certain calls. They have some voting rights on these art proposals. So it's a membership. And again, it's not super high stakes in terms of decision making, and it's not super high stakes in terms of financial investment. It's just like, yeah, like buying a membership to a club, and you see what's going to happen in that club. You get to be part of all the cool things that the club is doing, and you get to have some direction in where this club is going. So that's how we're seeing this.
Yeah, I love that. And actually, it reminds me, I think something Jason and I have talked a little bit about is maybe using a DAO for people doing doom or optimism type projects. And when you said the people who have been involved in your project so far are like long-term listeners of the podcast or people that you know personally, that made a light bulb go off for me, because there's people involved in doom or optimism, both people who have been hosts, who have written for the Substack, people I know who have taught in my class, who I like know and trust. And I can imagine doing a DAO with them, with all these people who I like know, I vetted, you know, and then coordinating, you know, like coordinating resources across that network. But the network is of people who are not anonymous to one another. Like, they are known to one another, they are vetted in the community. So yeah, I like that a lot. I have a different direction to go, unless Jason, you have any follow-up on this topic.
No, go for it.
Okay, so Chris D is one of our fans and friend of Doomer Optimism.
He, and contributor now. He recently.
Yeah, and contributor to the Substack. He asked the question, the whole journey of future thinkers from having podcasts about consciousness to localism, what was that shift or aha moment that got you to go from, you know, travel and consciousness to like smart villages, from nomadism to place-based? Like, what was that journey?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we were traveling for around 8 years in total. And for about half of that time, we were very mobile, like moving every few months or sometimes every month. And then for half of that time, we were in a place, we were in Plovdiv, Bulgaria, but we were still traveling quite a lot, but we did have a home base. And we just realized that, we needed to plant some roots and be part of a community, and especially, you know, wanting to have a child, that it becomes inherently necessary to form these stable long-term relationships, rather than have something more like, we've met awesome friends in our travels, like people that we're still in touch with, that we still speak with and, you know, hold dear. But it's challenging because they're on the other side of the world and we don't get to see them. So we wanted something more local. And for me, having a relationship with land is very important. I've always wanted that. I grew up on a, you could call it a small homestead in Russia, and, you know, growing our own food and raising our own animals. It was like, you know, the highlights of my childhood, and also traveling, actually, there were some of the highlights of my childhood. So yeah, I just wanted that again. And I wanted my son to grow up in that kind of environment, you know, surrounded by trusted people, friends, family, neighbors. You know, it takes a village to raise a child. So I wanted that for him. And
like, we're gonna make the village.
Yeah.
that's really beautiful. I just have a comment, and then Jason, you can go. So I traveled a ton too in my 20s, and I reached a point where I was like, I was traveling with my boyfriend at the time, and I was just like I feel really lonely. You know, the two of us going around, it was just us with each other, and then like it was lonely to not have like stable friends for me, like, you know, throughout this period, and not like really belong anywhere. That was a big part of my journey. And then I was like, yeah, let's settle somewhere. And we settled in Uruguay. But then I think I've also come to the realization, like, despite wanting to be place-based, also like, travel is fun still though. Like, and like, having a place to come home to you know, it makes travel even more sweet, at least to me. So I think, yeah, I went this whole arc. I think maybe it's similar to you, but like go travel, like infinite travel to like.
Oh, have we lost Ashley?
Mm-hmm.
Has she frozen for you as well, Yubi?
Yeah.
Okay. Ashley, we've lost you.
Okay. Oh, you're back.
I think you're back, Ashley.
Okay, I'm back. Hi. 1, 2, 3, testing.
Yeah. So you were talking about this arc in this whole full circle.
And that's yeah. So basically, yeah, I just went through this whole, you know, arc of traveling a ton to being it, wanting to be in a place and now like having some nuance balance between the two. Jason, I think he doesn't want to go anywhere anymore. He's a true localist, right?
Well, I spent a lot of my 20s traveling. I was a world citizen and, you know, through my early 30s. And now I'm pretty content. Like, I just hate getting on airplanes. You know, I still have to like visit family, which I feel like that's important, but I wish they were just all around. But yeah, I mean, for me, like I'm really interested in just building up our homestead and our, you know, and contributing to kind of bioregional activities and county, you know, even, you know, right now, really even smaller scale, like, you know, within our county and town and, you know, making connections, you know, nearby and developing friendships. We've only been here for a couple of years. So yeah, I mean, that there's no urge to travel really, at least not to far off places. I'm sure that will change. I'm sure that will change as well. I want to get to, just to get both people who ask questions, Eclectic Spacewalk, who's a big friend of Doomer Optimism. He says that he loves future thinkers and that they were a big inspiration for his own project and him and his partner's project. He wants to know a little bit about kind of how formative was being in a relationship with Mike and like for both of you, like in terms of your growth and how he also asked how a child changed them. And then he asked, what were the most compounding growth decisions, the courses, the villages? So feel free to just, you know, bring in whatever you feel like you haven't already said to that question so we can make sure that, mm-hmm. the question is asked.
Yeah, well, the relationship has definitely been a very growth spurring. And doing all the things, you know, traveling and meditating and doing this podcast and just like all the things that we've done together throughout the more than a decade has been very growth oriented. But at the same time, it's grounding, you know, having a relationship is grounding. And especially now having a child is even more grounding. So how would I say it? Like I used to read a lot more books when we were traveling just because time and, you know, fewer kind of responsibilities and more capacity to engage with abstract ideas. And now for me, everything is very tangible a lot more. You know, I have a toddler and
yeah. How old is your son?
He's 2.5.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's very, I have to be responsive a lot. I, you know, everything abstract has to be grounded in the tangible, in the real, in the day-to-day. And being out here on the land, things are always, you know, emerging. There's like the water management is such a huge deal here. You know, something's always either flooding or drying out or being plugged up. And we have several streams here and, you know, beavers are constantly trying to build a dam in the culvert and muskrats are plugging up the pipes and, you know, stuff is always happening that needs your attention. So we can't be just engaging with these abstract ideas. We have to be hands-on and everything is grounded in this kind of, in the dirt, in the sand, in the soil, in the water, in, you know, relationships that are here. So that's been a big change. I would say that relationship in general is everything, grounding everything in the context of relationship has been such an important thing. This is something that I don't know if you guys are familiar with Tyson Yunkaporta. He talks about this quite a lot, that, you know, in Indigenous Australian culture, everything is always grounded in relationship. It's like there's no such thing as an abstract idea or an abstract concept that is detached from relationship. Like, even if you're learning something, it's always important, like, well, who are you learning it from? And what are their relationships? Like, who are they in their community? And those kinds of questions are important. You always have to investigate sort of what is that relationality? Like, nothing exists as a separate thing. So I really like that. And, you know, we're getting more and more of that as we're being more embedded here with relationships, with family, with neighbors, with, you know, our physicality.
I love that. I think for me, like, I lately have been, had a couple episodes, like, with fellow moms and people talking about family. And I just feel like these things are so related. The embodied relationship to land is so related to, like, your embodied relationship to your partner and children, and then ideally, like, extended family and community. And, like, it really is just, like, such a sharp juxtaposition between that, the embodied work and, like, the abstract. And again, like I said before, with the travel and home, like, they do inform one another, and I think there is room for both, but I think probably most of us modern people under a certain age go too far in the abstract direction, and so it's really nice coming into that the project of embodiment in multiple forms. So that's really, really cool. So what should we be looking out for from you guys? Like, what are next steps? Like, how can people get involved if they want to? You know, what are the proximate next steps, and what are the, like, big picture goal, you know, down the line ideas?
Yeah. Well, big picture goal down the line, I would say that it's emergent. You know, people often come to us and ask, like, okay, well, what are your, like, 1, 2, 3, you know, plan, step, exact, you know, clear, can nail down thing of what you're doing. And I just think that's the wrong question to ask, because life has got a life, and it's always lifing, and it's always emergent and evolving and changing and in response and in relationship to everything that's happening. And I feel like I'm channeling Nora Bateson right now. But yeah, that's, you know, that's it. And of course we have a vision, but it's always in relationship to what is actually happening here. And the people that are here, and the land, and what the land wants. I just keep coming back to that. Like, what does this land want to be? Because it does have those kinds of tendencies, and you can think of it as a living thing with its own desires, for sure. And we are in relationship with that living thing. So I'm much more interested in talking about what's emerging rather than what is our plan. As far as what's next in a more immediate sense, well, so we're starting our permaculture garden this year. You know, I've got a ton of seeds and seedlings and saplings that are coming. And I've already started seeds, and they have, you know, more things coming in the mail soon when it's warm enough to plant them. So we're going to need help, for sure. So if anybody wants to come out and help us with that stuff, you know, setting up hugelkultur, garden beds, and planting trees and things like that. People are welcome to come out, and we're offering a trade where people can camp here at no cost, and they just get to help us with the work and, you know, stay for a few days or a few weeks and get to know us and see how it goes.
The woofing model. That's great.
Yeah. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As far as there's just the endless work here, you know, there's so much to do. So, you know, especially if people are skilled tradesmen of any kind, you know, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, builders. We'd love for them to come out and you know.
In our future world, tradespeople are probably the most highly valued.
Yeah, yes. Totally. I mean, not same. Future. I mean, all of us on homesteads are like, yeah. Please, somebody who knows anything about electricity, yeah. Please come. Woof. We had a carpenter, like a master carpenter, woof with us one time, and I was like, he did so much, like everything Aurelien touched. He was from France on vacation here in Uruguay, and he was brought here to build, I don't know why he was brought, but he was brought here to build this museum in the east part of the country. And he found us and he stayed here for like 2 weeks, and he built so much in that time. I was like, if you can get people with those kind of skills, and obviously you're trying to build up those skills yourself, but it's totally different with the actually skilled people.
Yeah, 100%. It's so funny, you know, people sometimes think like, oh yeah, in the future we'll all be coders and whatever. No, that's not true. Who is going to build the infrastructure? Who is going to fix the plumbing and set up the electrical?
Like, yeah, maybe you can be a coder too, but you also need those other skills, like, or at least the base level of them.
Yeah, and there's a huge shortage of it, especially among young people. Like, you know, all the tradespeople that we have here are older, they're boomers. And, you know, when they get too old to do the work, who's going to do it? It's actually a really big problem out here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, so that's the physical thing.
let me ask you real quick, just to, you're starting these permaculture gardens and stuff and planting trees. What kind of trees? What kind of trees are you getting in the ground?
Oh, sure. This is very exciting for me. So we are here in Hardiness Zone 3. So it's very cold.
Yeah.
That's intense.
This winter, one weekend, we got 2 feet of snow. In one weekend. So you can imagine how much that is. That's a yeah. lot.
Which did you say which province you're in of Canada?
We're in British Columbia.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But we're in the mountains. So okay. it's very cold. You know, if you're in the lower mainland, like close to Vancouver, it's a lot more mild. But up here, it gets very, very cold. But it's beautiful. Like, we have very sunny winters, you know, winter wonderland, you know, everything is covered in snow. It's gorgeous.
It's sunny. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not gray and gloomy like in Vancouver or Seattle or those places. Yeah. But it's
that makes a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. So for your psyche, for your soul, it's very nice. Because I lived in Vancouver for 11 years or something, and I just couldn't handle the gray in the winter. But this is totally different. So what we're planting is I found this one good nursery that is in Saskatchewan, and it's even colder there, is zone 2. So they have very hardy varieties that they've collected from around Canada and the States and Russia and Manchuria. They have really cool varieties of super hardy, you know, pears and apples and plums and grapes and cherries, lots grapes. Of berries. Cool. Yeah, exciting. Even grapes, amazingly. Wow. Yeah, Valiant grape and a couple of other types of grapes. And lots of berries do really well. So, you know, raspberries, blackberries, hardy blackberries, blueberries, gooseberries, lots of different berries.
God, what is that berry that they had in Washington?
Pascap.
No, it's I'll have to look it up, but they had this berry in Washington where I lived in Pullman, Washington, and like people had you know, spots where they knew where it was, and they could, like, they would never tell you where it was, and it was like up in the mountains, and you can only get it like a certain you know, 2 weeks a year or something like that. That'll be fun for you. It'll be like one of those things where when things are producing, it'll be like insane amount of production, but it'll only be like 2 weeks or something where you can like really harvest for some of those plants.
Yeah. The way that I've done it is I've picked varieties that fruit at different times so that we can stagger it a little bit.
Yeah.
That's smart. Yep.
You don't have to process everything like 1,000 pounds of fruit in one weekend.
Yeah. And I'm starting small. Like, I just got, you know, one of each for most things, just to try it and see what we like. And yeah.
What are you thinking about animals at all at anytime down the line?
Yeah, we are. So we want to do a chicken coop. I don't know if we'll get to it this year. It really depends on how much help we can get, because there's just so much labor already involved in running the operation here. So, you know, it depends on, if we can get volunteers at the right time who have the right skills. So it'll be either this year or next year, the chicken coop. And then we want to get some bigger animals, either pigs or goats, maybe sheep. A lot of our neighbors have goats here and they've offered as babies, so we might try that. But I know that goats are pretty, they have personalities. They try to escape all the time and they eat everything. So, but I have goats in my ancestry. Like, I'm part Bulgarian and all of my ancestors had goats. So I kind of feel like kinship with that animal. So I might try to attempt it, even though a lot of permaculturists have said that goats are a pain in the butt.
Harder to manage, but more, I don't know, have more personality than sheep.
I looked it up. Huckleberries was the berry.
Huckleberries. We have the wild here.
Right. Okay, and then what else are you working on? The non-material world stuff.
Non-material world.
Yeah, the metaverse stuff.
Yeah, the metaverse stuff. So the DAO, it's called Portal DAO, actually. So this is a thing that I want to explain why Portal. You know, the internet has kind of become a place that people go to. And I actually think that's potentially a bad use of that technology. I'm much more interested in the internet as a portal to real places, real people, real human connection, real wisdom, real knowledge, where we go through it into embodiment, into something real. So, you know, things like VR, I'm actually not a fan of. I don't like it. I'm not interested in it. I mean, sometimes it's fun, but I don't want to make that a kind of any kind of meaningful part of my life.
Maybe if I was like to help me augment planning, you know, planning out site design for, you know, for design, you know, maybe I could see a potential, but besides that.
But that's a portal too. It's like a portal from the way things currently are.
Speaking Ashley's language, because I think we've talked about the internet as a place before, and I argue that it is a place and she didn't like it, but I actually like this idea of it being a portal more. So
yeah, I love it. And actually, you know,
United Ashley and I in our
exactly. And it reminds me, because we just recorded an episode with a guy who studies people who are in bunkers, and he spoke about the people in the bunkers, talking about the bunkers as like a portal or a bridge from like one period of time to the next. So I don't know. I'm loving this. This metaphor is
coming up. It also extends, I think, to where we are in our civilizational lifestyle cycle, right? Of like, we know that the old world is kind of not going to last, and we're not quite at the new world yet. And we're kind of like in this portal, this transition.
Totally.
So it's just an all purpose. So anyway, go ahead.
great. We love it. We're on board.
We hijacked your description, so keep going.
Yeah, well, I'm glad the meme resonates. That's awesome. Yeah, so that's being launched. We're launching the token for it on June 1st, and the token is called Archetypes. Mm. So these are the NFTs, and it's going to be a collection of 5,000 unique NFTs, and then we're going to do another 5,000 later, so it'll be 10,000 in total. And they are, they're based on sort of Jungian-ish archetypes. And we're starting with six. So that's king, warrior, magician, lover, creator, explorer. And then there's going to be six more, which is mother, sage, jester, outlaw, every person. And I'm missing one. What is it? It'll come to me. So these 12 archetypes are what the tokens are based on. And they're not necessarily personalities. They're more like aspects of human cognition, sort of their modes of being, if you will. And, you know, things that we can draw on in terms of wisdom and sort of processes that we can connect with. And we wanted it to be something deep and something very human. So that's why we chose archetypes as a theme, because I think it's been a very sort of generative and useful theme in our lives. And we've done a podcast series on archetypes. So futurethinkers.org/archetypes is, I think, the link to the series if people want to listen to that. So anyway, this NFT collection is launching on June 1st, and that'll be the membership token for the DAO. This like club that people can participate in with us if they're interested in these sorts of things, in, you know, regenerative projects, in homesteading, and how Web3 can become part of it, and portals to new worlds, and solar punk, and all these different Game B and these kinds of memes that we like to play around with.
Well, you guys do that, and you go first, and then you can teach us the Doomer Optimists what to do and what not to do. We're behind. We're thinking about it, but we're just like, you know, ruminating a bit. So it'll be cool to watch your journey. It's exactly, you know, and see how it works.
Yeah, you and then can. We can step on all the rakes so that you guys can hopefully not have to.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for being the sacrificial ones. Anything else that we haven't covered? This was lovely. It was really lovely to meet you. We're so much aligned. There's so much going on that I think, you know, we should be in touch and keep collaborating too, because there's a lot. We're doing a similar kind of thing, network, regenerative projects, lots of people into homesteading. And people, you know, a subgroup of people into Web3 things. So
cool.
Anything else we haven't yet covered that you
guys? Is there like a question that you do a lot of podcasts and it's like nobody can think to ask you? It's just like, come on, people, like, don't be so dull. Like ask me this really good question that's just hanging there. Is there a question like that that you would like to both be asked and answer?
I think we discussed a lot of good things. It's sometimes it's hard, especially when you're in something. It's hard to see from the outside, you know. So I've enjoyed all the questions that you guys have asked. And we've talked about some things that are really bad ideas. I think that's generally something that gets underexplored.
Yeah.
Because people are like, what should I do? Or like, what's a good idea? But I think it's really important to touch on the really bad ideas as well.
Yeah, I think that was, maybe one last question could be, so far in your process, let's say on the village building, so far, what is like one mistake you've made that you feel like looking back, I should not have done it that way, and what you learned from it? Because we said we should ask that question more often. Like, tell us a mistake you made and what we can learn from it. Or do you not think that way? A lot of times when people do make mistakes, it was just like part of an emergent learning process and like had to happen kind of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of our line of thinking. Like it was all generative, and it you know, it was good in the long run. Well, like the first property that we put an offer down on, it was a beautiful farm that had already regenerative agriculture happening on it for decades. And, you know, they had different animals that they were rotating and all this really cool stuff. It was beautiful, beautiful place. And then, you know, in the end it fell through. And that was actually a really good thing because, first of all, the zoning would have been a nightmare to deal with, like, because it was agricultural, so we wouldn't have been able to build buildings on it. There's only this one other rocky patch of the land where we could build the buildings, and it would have just been a huge pain in the butt. And secondly, it was in this Kootenai region where, you know, people would have been probably less welcoming of our ideas. And they were actually in many ways. There were just a whole bunch of other things. You know, the business model of this one that we have now with the campground is actually a lot better and a lot more conducive to having a lot of people come out and stay here. And so in the end, you know, that quote unquote mistake actually worked out for the best, and we learned something from it. And I would say it's been the same with a lot of other things. One thing that kind of comes to mind as a theme is that idealism is actually really bad. Any kind of utopianism, like imagining that something is just going to solve all of your problems and that'll be it, they'll just be like happily living ever after, it's just, it never works out that way, and it's a really bad idea. And sometimes if you try to stick very kind of bullheadedly to your ideas, you end up, you know, at worst actually hurting things, like hurting people, hurting possibilities, you know, hurting just, yeah, like life is not fixed. It just, it's, and it doesn't conform to your ideas about what you think should and shouldn't be. So it's always a dance, you know, you're always dancing with the reality about like, oh, is this possible? Is this good? Is this generative? And you work things out through that dance. And I think that's the, you know, that's what's worked for us. And that's always, sometimes you don't know how things are going to happen, and then they just happen amazingly because you have the right people at the right time in the right place, and you know, nature lends a hand, and yeah, things just emerge. I'm not saying that you just throw caution to the wind and do things without planning. Planning is absolutely a good idea, but like holding them loosely, I guess, like a plan is not, the map is not the territory.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that totally resonates. That's something we've talked a lot about, the project, you know, everybody's project, it seems like, who resonates with Doomer Optimism, at least, seems like anti-utopian. Like, we're just going to be, I mean, we have like values and parameters, but and goals, but to not try to muscle the world into a utopian vision is a common theme, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah. And just like being idealistic about, oh, like sometimes people who are interested in the green meme, you know, interested in regeneration from sort of a city perspective, have very kind of false idealistic ideas about how it actually works.
Yep.
you know, they're like, oh, you know, but you have diesel vehicles, like, oh, you know, in the future we will all not be driving vehicles and it'll just be all happy-go-lucky, you know, with electric vehicles. And I like to question those kinds of things because A, electric vehicles just aren't practical. We actually considered getting a Tesla, and then having been here for a year, it's just not going to work out, I don't think. Like, you know, we are in the boonies and it's muddy and rocky and this
you'd delicate... you'd have better luck with a donkey cart probably for your transport.
Yeah, I don't
know. We're seriously considering donkeys, by the way, Jason, after I listened to Jeff McFadden's. Yeah, nice. They just seem so great. They seem so great. And they don't seem like that hard to deal with. So anyways, sorry to hijack that, but yeah, I think that also resonates a lot. A lot of people want to get into the nitty gritty and learn where some of their preconceived notions about how things work in reality and in nature. You know, I think, I got totally schooled on how everything works once I moved rural, and I'm really grateful for it, but it's past time arguing with city people, myself being a former city person, you know, about how things work is it's slow, but people are learning little by little and interested to learn, so that's good.
Yeah, and people's idea about sustainability, just that like nature is this untouchable, mysterious thing that we should just leave, you know, over there, and here we are people, we are civilized, we're not nature. Well, that's completely false, because we are nature, we are part of nature, and nature isn't always as fluffy as people think. You know, they're like, for example, the beavers. We have beavers here and they are a pain in the butt. They are
this was, constantly... this was This was surprising to me because I thought like there's no place that like had too many beavers, but apparently there are. And like where people are like actually having to like, you know, fight for their territory with against beavers, which is fine. I mean, it's good to hear like that there's so much an abundance that you're having to like fight them back to taking over your infrastructure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we are in the middle of a provincial park here. So we're literally surrounded on all sides by wilderness, and it's one of the biggest provincial parks in the province. So yeah, we have a lot of wildlife here, and beavers are a pain in the butt. They're constantly trying to build their dam in the culvert because there's, you know, a natural barrier. There's a grate, and that's just the most logical place because it's already there. So they just, yeah, constantly trying to build their dam there. And we constantly, in the summer, every few days, we have to come in with the excavator and like tie the bucket to the grate and pull out this. Sometimes it's literally a ton of wood branches that they've stuck in there. And yeah, we have to undo the dam every few days. And, you know, we had to call in a neighbor who's a professional trapper. You know, he's licensed to deal with the beavers. So he, you know, trapped the beaver and took him away. But like, you can't come at this with an idealist view, because if we just let the beaver do his thing, the whole thing is going to get flooded. You know, our valley is very low. The water table is already very high. So it's going to flood the whole thing, is going to flood the neighbors, is going to cause, you know, thousands, maybe millions of dollars of damage. So we have to deal with the beavers.
Yeah. And it's good. Yeah. And for me, well, we have ants that are like always so insane here in Uruguay, and it's us or the ants. I mean, I'm sorry. They're not going to come in and like eat our food or like infest our house or bite us. Like, you know, there's other things we can cohabitate with, like in a more harmonious fashion, but there are certain things like, you know, I'm an animal in this ecosystem too. And you know, I gotta defend my territory.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, one of the things we had happen, so we had somebody come in who likes our vision, and he was saying like, why aren't you composting on day one? Like, you gotta be composting right away. And we're like, dude, we have bears out here. And once they get a taste of your compost, they will be here every day. And, you know, the adolescent bears are quite aggressive. So it's going to be a problem. And then you're going to have to end up calling a conservation officer who's going to come in and shoot the bear. Like, that's the reality of the situation. That's what's going to happen if you let them get into your garbage. So you need to build this very heavy bear-proof structure to contain your compost. Mm-hmm. And we are in the middle of the camping season. We are working 12 hours a day, every single one of us, like, it's just not going to happen. Sorry, no composting this year. And he was just so disillusioned by it. He's like, you are not as sustainable as you say you are because you're, you know, not composting. Yeah. It's just silly. Like, you have to be
realistic.
You have to be realistic and embedded in what is actually happening here.
Yeah.
So
I've certainly learned, and this speaks to, I think, we've talked about this whole conversation, is that I see this as kind of a, you know, hopefully a multi-generational project, and
yes,
not taking on too much at one time, like little by little. You know, like I want to get larger livestock as well, like goats or sheep, but it's just like, okay, we're having another baby this year, not going to happen this year, maybe next year, and that has to be okay, right? It's not, you know, like maybe my grandkids will live in a solar punk utopia here, but you know, I'm okay with just kind of like, you know, just stumbling around and getting, you know, things set up little by little.
Yes, absolutely. That's also been the thing. And we've expected it because, you know, I grew up in the countryside, and I lived in Bulgaria for a few years, and things are a lot less developed and structured and westernized there. So you're face to face with the reality of how long things take, a lot more. So I was under no illusion that it was going to happen right away. But even then, our timelines have gotten stretched because, yeah, permitting and the reality of just maintaining this place and, and needing the right people to be here at the right time to do certain things is just going to take longer than we expected, and it's going to cost more, and it's going to be more bureaucratic and more of a pain in the butt. It doesn't mean we're not going to do it. It's just, yeah, it's going to take longer. So, and it's funny because people who live in the city often have these assumptions that everything just happens, you know, because somebody else is doing it. It's because it's not, not you doing it. Or even if you are doing it, you are resting on top of these systems that have been created and have been in place for centuries often. And people just take them for granted, you know, that like when you flush the toilet, the poop goes somewhere and you don't have to worry about it.
You don't think here about that,
yeah, that's not the case. Like the septic tanks are have to be maintained and have to be put in. Like right now we're actually trying to get permits to put in a new septic tank so we can do another development and put more structures on the land. And it's a process. So we're always interacting here with like the life support systems, you know, with the waste management, with the water, with the power, with everything. It's all our responsibility, and
which is good, which is a good, and then you have skin in the game, but you know, it's also like, yeah, you're having to learn all these skills at once. One comment before we wrap up, it seems to me in some ways the image of like a steward or a husband comes to mind for your project, and not just of the land, but of the community and the people and the vision and all the different activities. It's like you guys are sort of stewarding these things all at once. And it's almost like alchemy, including the human side of things. Like, oh, we've just got to toss these little bits in and see what works well together. It's cool. It's very creative. It's exciting. The potential is really huge for if you get like the right moment and it's like the right group and everything's coming together, and then maintaining that, it's cool. There's a lot of exciting potential. So I've got to run. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. It was lovely to meet you. I hope we can collaborate more. And last words.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys. It was great to meet you, Ashley. Great to see you again, Jason. Happy to continue chatting and collaborating, and I'll send you an invite to our DAO, and hopefully you can play around in it a little
bit. Yeah, right, exactly.
We'll probably start off with like flies on the wall, just like, what the hell are they talking about? But
just click around, see how it works.
I think the DAO for us is like the compost. It's like, okay, we need a structure just to even understand what the hell it is, and then
we need a bear proof DAO, Jason.
We need a bear proof DAO, because we're the bear. This is
all right, cool.
It's great to I think we hosted you on both end like 3 years ago with Jared, and it's great to catch up again, you know, after I think both of our lives have changed quite a bit. I hope we can, you know, our respective spheres can kind of stay connected. And I definitely see, you know, room for collaboration and, you know, trading war stories and stuff in the future. So it's great to have you on.